Good. So, we talked about,
we were talking about Schopenhauer mostly last time, this idea of the way that in Europe in the 19th century there's this idea that emerges about a sort of bottom-up approach to consciousness, bottom-up approach to rationality, this sort of thing. And Schopenhauer is described in terms of representation being a manifest, well, representation that it's consciousness or rationality, logic, these sorts of things, being a manifestation of what in sort of more currently acceptable terms you might describe as physical, chemical, biological processes. So in Darwin, we have this idea of consciousness as an adaptation that is useful for survival, etc. And we were talking a little bit about the way that this applies to his dream theory. So just a few things. Freud develops this idea of the three aspects of consciousness. The unconscious is really the locus of these sort of unknown desires that in some sense are nonetheless known. We tend to act in ways that sometimes seem very inscrutable, and yet at the same time, if we freely associate from dreams or from perhaps artistic creation, these sorts of things, we can start to unravel the unconscious motivators that drive our action and our conscious choice, this sort of thing. The preconscious is sort of interesting, and I'll just spend a little bit of time on this because it's important for his theory of dreams and the way it works. I think the conscious mind is more or less pretty straightforward. You know, it's everything that we know we're thinking about, basically. But the preconscious is a little bit strange because it's accessible to our consciousness, but its subject collapses. So we're talking about like Freudian slips, paraphraxis, this kind of thing where you say one thing. I won't make the joke this time. Well, I can't resist. You know the joke? A Freudian slip is where you say one thing and mean another. But what's interesting about that is that that's something that's happening in the preconscious, there's a word, so you can't actually come back and recover the thing that you meant to say. It's just for some reason, automatically, we tend to, at various points, say something that we don't mean. Perhaps out of force of habit. Force of habit, by the way, is another element of the preconscious. So that you're walking somewhere, you decide, oh, I need to go to the post office. But as you're walking to the post office, for whatever reason, you end up walking to some bar that you usually go to. Well, that's very strange because I consciously chose to walk one place and yet somehow I ended up here, you know. So these are the sorts of things that are operating within the preconscious where you're not actually aware of walking to the place that you didn't mean to go to, and yet at the same time somehow you ended up there, but you're also able to sort of recapture the fact that you wanted to go somewhere else and why it might have been that you ended up walking to the place you didn't mean to go. The thing about the preconscious, which is really interesting when it comes down to dream theory, is that this is the part of the conscious where he talks about there being a sensor in the mind when you dream. And so what you might know about repression is this idea where there's some thing that you don't want to admit to yourself. It might be a desire, it might be trauma. Whatever it is, it's in the unconscious, and somehow you can't bring yourself to admit that you have either this experience or this desire. The preconscious is that element of the mind, which is the consciousness that hides those things from the conscious mind. And so it's referred to as the sensor quite often. And one of the things that's really interesting about this is this idea that our minds might be hiding our true selves from ourselves. And in the history of, say, philosophy, you know, there's always this idea that through reason, through rationality, rational reflection, you can more or less know thyself, in the words of Socrates. But there's not necessarily this idea that the self is actively putting barriers in the way of you finding yourself. There's just this idea that if you consciously think about it enough, that you'll be able to know thyself. But it's not the case that thyself is actually actively trying to hide it from your knowledge. And this is something that begins with Freud, which I think is a little bit interesting, the way that in this model, there's actually this sort of, you could say, struggle, perhaps. I think that, in a way, these aspects of consciousness are probably more integrated than just if you have unconscious and consciousness and they're constantly in a struggle. But this idea that the preconscious is, in a sense, a domain of the conscious mind that affects defense mechanisms, right? And that's exactly what the idea of repression boils down to, a defense mechanism. So let's say you have some kind of excitation, right? Like some, in case of trauma, it's going to be some thing that happened to you that is so traumatic that if you think about it, your mind just can't process it, basically. And so what it does by way of defense mechanism, very much like when you vomit or something like that, it's like it actively attempts to somehow deflect the energy, the psychic energy. When I say psychic energy, it sounds a bit new agey, but what this means is basically just that you have emotional energy. There are neurons firing to create emotions, and if the emotion is so intense that your system can't handle it, it has to deflect that to some other mental representation. So instead of sticking with the, you know, it's always a little bit weird talking about psychoanalysis here, because most of the examples are always about child molestation and this sort of thing, you know. But and statistically, it's borne out that child molestation usually occurs at the hands or by the hands of a caregiver. And so it's interesting that the relationship of the child to the molester is usually one of dependency and also on some level of love. And then at the same time, there's this abuse that takes place. And so the idea with depression is that the pain of the abuse, and it might not even just be emotional pain, it might be actually literally physical pain as well. It's all sort of bound up together with this strange element of dependency and love, that the emotional content of the mental representation of being molested is so intense that your body just can't process it. And so it has to change that mental representation of molestation into something else. That's basically the idea. And that's what the preconscious is doing as a sensor. It's taking these things that are so hard to deal with, traumas, desires, and somehow turning it into something else, that where you don't understand or you don't immediately see the connection. And that's more or less what's happening in dreams, that you have some desire that is perhaps not a desire that you can accept, that you can accept for yourself. And so what the mind does is somehow change that desire into some other image, basically. That's more or less the mechanics of this. Just a few things, since, you know, you're probably familiar with these terms, and it's a little bit useful to kind of put them in their specific context. The other three-part division of the consciousness in Freud, which is important to talk about. This is actually later than the levels of the conscious, the preconscious, and the subconscious or the unconscious. But the id, the ego, and the superego are important. One of the things about it that makes them seem all mystical or kind of pseudoscientific is, I think, the fact that we use Latin terms for them instead of translating them into English, because Freud actually uses English, or not either. He actually uses German words, and the word for the id is the S, which literally in English just means the id. The ego is the I, and the superego is the over-I, something that is beyond just the I. And so what we might mean by this, you know, before consciousness, why do we talk about people in terms of gender pronouns or you pronouns, these sorts of things, but we talk about animals as it's. It's because we think of them as basically not having developed rational capacities and faculties, these sorts of things, right? Why do you talk about a tree as an it instead of a tree as having some sort of identity as a you? Well, it's because what a tree is basically just this manifestation of biological, chemical, physical forces, but it doesn't have consciousness, right? And so Freud's basic claim is that there is a component to our consciousness that just is that. It's this it. It's not a union. It's just the it that is. It's very much like what Schopenhauer is describing with the will. It's just this sort of substrate of naturalistic, mechanistic processes or interactions, these sorts of things. The I, and I'll say also the it, since it's up here, is where these sorts of desires originate. The desire for reproduction, the desire, hunger, these sorts of just base biological necessities originate at this level that's not quite conscious yet. It's not quite a you. Because, plants and animals, amoebas, I suppose, all exhibit these inclinations towards these behaviors. Right? We wouldn't necessarily call it hunger in the case of an amoeba, because an amoeba is not conscious of it, but it still nonetheless exhibits the behavior of hunger. It exhibits the behavior of reproduction, these sorts of things. And so this is why Freud is putting desires and drives at this basic subconscious it level. That's before the I. The I, then, is in some sense both the preconscious and the conscious, because it is the component of consciousness that reality checks. It basically receives the instincts, it receives the energy of the instinct or the desires, and then checks them against reality, whether or not it's realistic, possible, desirable, even in a larger sense, to, for instance, act under inclinations for aggression or reproduction of these various sorts of things. The superego is quite interesting, and this is where we move sort of into the world of philosophy to a certain degree, because the uber-ich, or the superego, is part of the ego, but it's that part of the ego, that part of your conception of yourself, that is in dialogue with or is influenced by society. And so, if you think about morality, for instance, the fact that you probably shouldn't, you walk down the street and you see a homeless man that has his day's panhandling there, and he's asleep, and you say, there's nobody here, I'll just take this. But morally, that there's something wrong with that. How do you know that there's something wrong with it unless that's something that's come out of the teachings, the various sorts of societal norms and values that you've been brought up with? And at the same time, it's not just it's this abstract level of laws that are out there. You get arrested. You actually deeply feel that it's wrong. Not just that you shouldn't do it because you just end up in jail. This is more or less the way that the superego is working. It's in dialogue with the I, but sort of the I spread out to the level of society, where now it's not just about, is it possible for you to take the man's money, right? Because the id, just sort of, it doesn't really necessarily care whether or not it's possible to eat something if you're still hungry, right? So you could be in a room and be hungry and you want to eat, but it's not like the id is aware of the fact that you're unable to eat. It still creates the desire. The I would say, no, I'm in this room and I can't eat, so I have to do something else with my hunger. But then the superego is this way in which society and the self, each individual, is sort of in this dialogue, basically. What did I want to say? There was one other thing I wanted to say about that. But maybe it'll come back to me. So, collective consciousness, laws, rules, prohibitions. I mean, both the ego and the superego act to prohibit the desire that comes out of the id. That's basically the picture. Yeah.
So, what would, psychopaths be? Would they just not have the superego, I guess?
I suppose. I'm not a clinical psychologist, so you'll have to take whatever I say with a grain of salt. Probably. I mean, what they would have a lowered capacity to, or a lowered faculty, sort of an insufficient, non-functioning faculty of the superego, because they certainly are able to reality check, mm-hmm. right? Because, and in fact, that's one of the things that makes psychopaths so effective, that they are able to manipulate the system or the situation very easily. But at the same time, they don't necessarily have empathy. Empathy would be something that would be that would be a product of the dialogue between the ego and the superego. It's not just about you. We also have empathy for other people, right? And so in the case of a psychopath, there'd be something wrong in the world with the superego, basically. Because, you know, yeah, so that's where we are with the model of consciousness that Freud has. Just a couple more words about dreams, and then we'll get into some really interesting stuff. I had this up last time, but basically, Freud's early theory, which I think is actually a theory that many, many people hold today, not just in psychology and biology, but also in political theory. This is something you see quite a lot. This idea that really the sole motivator, when you strip away all, you know, individual interests, this sort of thing, sole motivator behind human activity is the desire for pleasure and the desire to avoid pain. You know, this is something that's described as a utilitarian bifurcation that you can basically reduce all human behavior to desires to increase pleasure and decrease pain, basically. That's the idea. And this is the idea that Freud's working with at the end of the 19th century. Now, that's sort of interesting, because what that means then, on the model of the three levels of consciousness, that what repression actually is, if you think about this idea that there are desires that are not made known to us, repression is a way to fulfill desires without actually having to fulfill them. So if you have a desire to make love to anything that moves, you certainly can't act on it, so you have to repress it. But repression is actually just a form of wish fulfillment. It, in a way, allows you to fulfill the desire vicariously through some other means, like proxy. And so there are three ways to do that. Sublimation, which we talked about a little bit before, for instance, this idea, certainly present in Wagner, that music is a sublimation of desire itself, right? And so, you know, you can't act on your desire, so what you do is make a great work of art. But, you know, quite often you'll see, sometimes in very lazy musicology, this idea that Beethoven is repressing his urges for aggression and this sort of thing by writing extremely virile, masculine sounding music, this sort of thing. But the idea is that if we can't act on our desires, then we can sublimate them into an artwork or into socially acceptable forms. Last time I gave the example of the surgeon, and I realized I didn't flesh out the example very well. I said, it might not just be a work of art, and it might not just be that you can't act on any conscious desire until you consciously sublimate it into something you can do. In the case of a surgeon, maybe even better than a surgeon would be a dentist. You know the movie Little Shop of Horrors? Is that in that movie? Okay, the dentist, right? How is he acting on his desire for aggression? By sublimating it into becoming a dentist, right? And so this idea that, you know, one possible way, this, it doesn't mean that everybody who's a dentist or a surgeon is sublimating their desire for aggression. And as I said, one of the problems with Freud is that it's not really generalizable from one case to another. And so you really have to go into the cases and see, the casework and see what the findings are. But the idea is that in some cases, there might be someone who has this tendency or this inclination for aggression and is constantly stifled by their parents, by their, you know, their priests or the various social authorities, and at the same time is moved into a line of work in which they get paid for cutting up people's bodies. Dexter would be, exactly. That's the conceit in Dexter. I haven't actually seen that show, but what little I know about it. Yeah, that's the basic idea in Dexter, that he's a serial killer, a surgeon, and he's a great surgeon because he also just loves cutting the bodies.
He's a crime detective.
Oh, he's a detective.
I'm just like
the
coroner.
Well, anyway, it's the same basic idea, right? The way that, on Freud's terms, That's a sublimation of an unacceptable desire, basically. Neuroses are a sort of repression where something goes wrong. So you try to gain mastery in some way that is not socially beneficial. And then dreams are another form of wish fulfillment that we're perhaps more familiar with. We'll talk a little bit more about dreams and the mechanics of dreams when we get to musique concrète. But one of the things that is interesting about Freud's early work is that if you take this model of motivation coming down to increasing pleasure and decreasing pain, then there's a question about how trauma works. And this is something that in the First World War becomes extremely widespread in Europe, because they many doctors, many psychoanalysts, Freud himself also, encounter patients that have these responses to trauma, wartime trauma, that's what we might call PTSD, that in which they're not repressing the trauma. They're actually constantly returning to the trauma, either in dreams or in various sorts of flashbacks, these sorts of things, where it's not that the pain of seeing your friend blown to bits is somehow repressed into some other image, but rather there's this sort of obsessive return to that painful image, right? And so if that's the case, then it can't just be that the desire for pleasure and the avoidance of pain are the complete explanatory model. What about these situations where people seem to desire pain, right? Now, in the case of trauma, certainly that is not, that's not a normal situation, because you know, you have to actually have experienced trauma and have some sort of, we tend to think of constant return to a painful experience in nightmares or in flashbacks to be something that is a product of an abnormal mind, perhaps, or mind has been damaged in some way. But in today's lecture, one of the things we'll see is that, and this is something that Freud develops, that in fact it's not abnormal at all. There's something deeply normal about the desire for pain and how pain actually is a very important part of our lives. So, in 1919, after his experiences with veterans in the First World War, he writes this sort of short book called Beyond the Pleasure Principle, in which he's trying to sketch out an alternative to this basically utilitarian approach of increasing pleasure or decreasing pain. And he asks these questions. Why is it that trauma victims compulsively revisit their traumatic experience rather than repress it? Now, this idea also, again, that it seems to transcend the libido, the pleasure principle. And the pleasure principle, if you think about it, I suppose in Schopenhauerian terms, is this idea that the will is constantly growing, right? This idea that we experience growth in terms of pleasure, we represent growth as pleasure. Whenever you are successful, we tend to experience it in terms of pleasure. So that the protraction of life is about reproduction, self-preservation, growth, this sort of thing. So then why constantly re-experience the trauma? Why constantly return to the pain? Now, there's something that he says about this, which is highly speculative. And in fact, in Freud's own words, he says, what follows is speculation, and in fact, often far-fetched speculation, which the reader will consider or dismiss according to his individual predilection. But what he basically sees, it's very interesting, because it's not just these war trauma victims where he sees this sort of pattern of returning, perhaps even obsessively, to a painful experience. In this book, the next thing that he mentions is this game that he sees his little nephew, it's like a five-year-old playing, where he's throwing this little ball that's attached to a string out of his crib and saying, it's in Vienna, so he's saying, fort, which means go or away, and then he pulls it back with the string and says, da, fort, da, fort. Die. And this is one of the parts where Pax gets a bit speculative. He says, well, it's very interesting that this five-year-old is so obsessed with this idea of losing and remastering, or losing and re-attaining this fall. And he develops this idea that it might have something to do with detachment anxiety from the mother, that the mother, you know, this is also 19th century Vienna, or early 20th century Vienna, and so the baby has a wet nurse and perhaps doesn't see the mother that often. But I don't even think you need to take Freud's example for this, because if any of you have kids, I have a daughter, kids love hide and seek. And hide and seek is a really strange game if you look at it, and especially when they're younger, before they really know how to hide, because all they're interested in is hiding important things, cherished toys, their own mother. So one of the things my daughter always used to do is she would make, she was 2 years old, make her mother hide behind the curtain. And then she'd pretend like she couldn't find her mother, which should be a traumatic thing, but it was a game. Somehow she liked to turn this possibly traumatic, painful experience into a game so that she could constantly recover her mother or her cherished toy or whatever she wanted. She would constantly like put blankets on top of her toys, certain things like this. And so it's sort of interesting. What is it about this idea of returning either in play or in war trauma to some sort of perhaps deeply painful experience? Now, one of the things he says about this as well is that it's not even just that they have this desire for mastery. It actually seems like they're driven to experience the pain in a pleasurable way. This is an insight that I think is extremely useful for art. I don't know how useful it is for psychology, but, you know, it's the sort of thing, I suppose, if you ever have campus sores, like, they hurt, but at the same time, you chew on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this bizarre sort of satisfaction. I don't know if I call it pleasure exactly, but there's this bizarre sort of drive to experience the pain, not to avoid the pain, but to experience it in a way that you have some control over. Like, you choose when you feel the pain, instead of avoiding the pain. So this is the crux of the idea. Like, what is this drive to experience pain as a meaningful experience, as perhaps even a pleasurable experience? And he comes up with this idea, and this is where it gets quite speculative. But the basic idea is this. It gets a little bit complicated. So one of the things to remember from Wagner, Schopenhauer, and basically every account of the structure of desire is that desire basically has this structure. It's a situation in which you have this unity, and desire is specifically a motion towards unity. So desire is the awareness of a lack of unity, basically. Right. So if you think about hunger, for instance, it's biological. Situation in which, well, what do you do when you're hungry? You are, in a sense, you have some sort of pain or discomfort. What you do is unify part of your external environment with yourself. You take a piece of food, you make it part of you. It actually becomes part of you. What about sexual desire? I mean, it's basically the same sort of thing. There's the unity of two people, the procreation is another form of unity. We see this in music, right? This idea that, well, what is the thing that we're desiring above all else in a piece of music? It's the cadence, right? It's this experience of disunity, and then everything comes to the same note. You move from dissonance, disunity, to unity. And in a piece of music, you experience this very, very directly. So the idea behind what I've written down here, the death instinct, this idea that this instinct for pain, is that beyond just the unity that we have of, say, taking a piece of food and making it part of ourselves, our environment part of ourselves, and so on, there seems to be, according to Freud, this desire on the part of the organism to achieve unity with its surroundings, mostly, basically in the most fundamental way possible, which is to say, to become unified with the inorganic world in death. This idea that there seems to be this strange sort of desire in some way to become part of the unified whole of the world, of your environment. And the only, and I suppose the most fundamental way to do this is in depth. He talks about it, these are his actual words, he talks about this strange sort of drive towards the quiescence of the inorganic world, dust to dust, etc. Now, again, this is where I said that it starts to move much more into philosophy than into, or poetry than, say, medical science. But, and Freud actually specifically says this as well. And yet, at the same time, he says, but I just can't shake this idea. It just seems to be something very right about this. And what we'll see is that this is, I think, very descriptive of the way that narrative works. The way that aesthetic experience, to a certain degree, at least narrative aesthetic experience, also works. But just by way of terminology, he describes two basic drives that, and he changes his viewpoint on this all over the place. And sometimes he thinks that one of these two drives is prior to the other. Sometimes he thinks that they're both sort of like in this mutual, struggle with each other. But he talks about Eros, desire, the life instinct, the instinct for growth. And then he talks about Thanatos, the death instinct, or the instinct for aggression. If you think about it in maybe less poetic, more neutral terms, you think about biological processes and these sorts of things, right? Logically, there's nothing, if we, well, of course I don't, I'm not completely up on the most current biological science necessarily, but it seems to me that there's nothing about the concept of growth that entails the concept of aggression. Just logically. It doesn't seem like you have to have aggression in order to have growth. Right? Yeah, I mean, that seems like a faith that's a defendable position anyway. It might just be the case that all the genes that create the desire for growth also create the desire for aggression. But logically, it's not the case that you need to have aggression in order to have growth. So then where does this desire for aggression come from? Right? And what he thinks is that desire for aggression is really one form of the death drive, that it's this desire for to annihilate, basically. This desire to annihilate others, perhaps even to annihilate the self. Now, this gets very interesting when we start applying it to art. Before we do that, I would like to say a few things, though. This will make it even more clear when we get to narrative theory. Because it's not just that we desire unity with the inorganic world, but rather, we desire unity on our own terms. And so here, for biological science, you can take two terms that are quite common. The difference between mutation and modification. Do you have a question?
No, I was going to comment on...
Okay, there's a place where I'll pause.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can you save your comment for
me? Yeah, I'll see.
Okay, great. So the difference between mutation and modification. So mutation, in evolutionary theory, is basically... this idea that there are spontaneous mutations in genomes and DNA, basically, that produce changes in species that may or may not be beneficial for survival. That's different from modification. Modification is a situation in which an organism's environment changes. And a change in environment can cause whole species to die out in a way that had nothing to do with their own genetic mutations, the series of genetic mutations that take place. And so what we see here is two possible ways that evolution can move in a particular direction. One is that you have spontaneous growth from inside. And then there's this other thing that can happen where, for instance, in 19th century Europe, you know about the story about how all the factories bubbling up smoke into the environment created a situation where I think certain moths I think the darker moths is that the darker moths died out because predators could see them better because of all the smog in the sky.
No.
Is the other way? Okay, well, right. Okay. That's a great example of modification, where it's not the organism that changes, it's the environment that changes. That something from outside the organism changes, which causes some of those species to die out and some to survive. And what Freud says is that this death drive, this drive for sort of unity, the absolute unity, is of the sort that we only feel fulfilled. We could only fulfill the death drive if we can die on our own terms, basically. Right? This idea that it has to come from within, that somehow your death has to be meaningful in your life narrative. It can't be that our deaths are meaningful because we don't choose it, in some sense. That death as a product of modification is not a fulfillment of the death drive. It has to somehow come from within. That's basically the idea. So, this is where narrative comes in, and it gets sort of interesting, especially thinking about this modification and mutation idea. So, on this account, it seems that the compulsion to repeat trauma, one of the things I said about it that is this desire to experience pain in a meaningful way, right? Meaningful perhaps because it's pleasurable or meaningful, or maybe pleasurable because it's meaningful. But the key to mastery of pain is that you fit it into some meaningful narrative, basically. Now, this is actually not coming from Freud. The narrative theory is coming from this guy named Peter Brooks, who adapts Freud's idea of the death drive to narrative theory. I don't have Peter Brooks' name up there, but just so you know. But now we're sort of outside of Freud, and we're applying these ideas from Freud's narrative theory. But the idea is basically this. If the organism desires, you know, equilibrium with the inorganic world on its own terms, then in the case of narrative, what this means is that the various painful experiences of our lives are acceptable as long as we're able to somehow gain mastery over them by fitting them into a narrative. Now, this is something that we know from Aristotle, actually, although maybe not so directly. It's not perhaps so obvious. But one of the things that Aristotle says, we're going to come back to Aristotle later as well, but we already have the distinction between plot and story. Remember, story is a series of events that take place in perhaps the actual world, and plot is the way that the story is told. So one of the things that Aristotle says in the Poetics is that a plot must be of a certain magnitude. What he means by that is that if a plot is too short, it's not very satisfying, right? This is something I encounter all the time in my classes where I have music students write pieces of music for the final projects, and I think we'll actually experience this in your midterm and final projects. One of the things that always happens is that they always ask me, what is the most efficient way? Like, what do I have to do in this assignment? Right? That's basically the way that they phrase it. It's like, you know, what are the minimum number of things I have to do in this assignment, I guess, to get an A? Which really could be rephrased as, what is the most efficient way to write this piece of music, right? And usually by efficient, they don't mean like, because one of the things, well, this wouldn't actually necessarily be efficient. One of the things I could say is, well, spend 25 years mastering the art of music composition, and then it's pretty easy. of course, that's not efficient on the grand scheme of things, I suppose. But this idea that something that they're missing, this idea that a plot, a narrative, has to be of a certain magnitude. And one of the things that Aristotle says, which at first glance seems kind of patently obvious, is that a narrative must have three parts. What three parts do you think they would be? Yeah, a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly a beginning, sort of have to start somewhere, have to end somewhere, but why a middle? Why is the middle so important? And why not just a middle? Why a middle of a certain magnitude? Why does it have to have a certain length? What's so important about the middle having magnitude? I tend to think of the middle as perhaps just being the happy medium or perhaps the domain of compromise or this sort of thing. What Aristotle seems to be saying is basically this, that the middle, well, if we synthesize Aristotle and Freud, one thing to take away from this is that the middle is important because it is the locus of meaningful failure. Right? It's where pain can be experienced in a way that we can gain mastery. Right? So the pain is not something that we want to avoid, because we actually get pleasure from the pain, but only in as much as we can somehow fit it into a meaningful narrative. Now, it's very interesting the way this works. I think this is a really great description of the thing we call the suspension of disbelief. Think about how the suspension of disbelief works. You go to a movie, the movie starts, you see a few images, basically a certain world is set up. And, certain movies take longer to set up their world, certain movies take less long. You have a certain set of expectations. Now, of course, you know that there's nothing at all very realistic about Star Wars, right? I mean, for one thing, there's no sound in space. And yet, that doesn't seem to bother us very much, because we're able to suspend our disbelief, which essentially means we're able to enter another sort of perhaps mode of evaluation that is operating not on the logic of our actual everyday experience, but on the logic of narrative. And what happens when suspension of disbelief is not such that it can contain something that breaks your suspension of disbelief? So, for instance, you're watching Star Wars, or maybe we'll take it back to Vertigo. You're watching Vertigo, and there's all this, sort of melodramatic talk of love and desire and everything. And at some point, a bunch of UFOs descend. Right? Or at some point, in the case of Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, where you have all these very intricate stories, everything stops and frogs just start raining down from the sky. You have some complete non sequitur that intrudes into the narrative, and you might experience as a bad thing. It's not the sort of thing that you can incorporate into the narrative. Maybe an even better example of this comes from a concert that I was at, where it was a piece for a solo saxophone player and electronics, and so the saxophone player was playing into a microphone and making all sorts of computerized sounds. And there was a moment where, I don't know what happened, there was some technical breakdown, and there was like a bunch of like really loud feedback, and then they didn't know what to do, so they just like shut off all the electronics, and the player just stopped, and then they're like, okay, sorry everybody, I guess we'll start over. Right, and so then they did it again, and then they didn't have the breakdown. And so that was a moment where that piece died by modification. Now think about this. The piece would have been really great if that moment had actually been part of the piece, right? Where the moment of breakdown, of technical breakdown, actually can be fit into this meaningful narrative where, you thought it broke down, but look, actually, that's part of the piece. We're able to make it into a meaningful narrative. Instead of the piece suffering death from outside, you have this moment of pain, rupture, even perhaps death of the piece, but it's from the internal logic of the piece instead of just some chance happening that came out of the environment, right? So, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I think is very descriptive of narrative, which means that when you go back to those undergraduates asking what's the most efficient way to write this piece, they really don't understand how narrative works, because if the middle is the locus of meaningful failure, that means it's not going to be, strictly speaking, efficient, because a completely efficient piece is typically taken to be a really bad piece of music. What makes a great piece of music is meaningful failure. Put into some, interesting, that's not sufficient, certainly, for a great work of art. But I think it is probably a necessary condition for a great work of art that it have meaningful failure in it. Which means that pain is not something that we always avoid, but rather the pain is something that gives life meaning, perhaps. And in fact, what I wrote down here at the bottom, that pain is a force that gives us meaning. In a way, that sounds sort of like a platitude, but think about just any situation in which any activity that you deem to be meaningful. Why is it meaningful? It's generally meaningful because it wasn't easy to obtain the situation that you think is meaningful. Right? There's a lot of struggle, a lot of pain, a lot of failure involved. And refers to that process by which pain is overcome and absorbed into a meaningful narrative. So this is one way of reading Freud's death drive, which I think is, in a way, kind of nice, because then there are ways of reading Freud's death drive which move more in the direction of this idea that we all somehow deeply desire self-destruction. I think there is something to that view. I won't go that far into it. Maybe we'll get into that other alternative view later on in the course. But one way of describing that natural path of addictions, I don't know if it's so every day or not, but when I was a kid, I used to freak myself out. 10 years old, 11 years old, puberty age, I guess. Because when I would walk across a bridge, I was like, I could jump off this bridge. And there was something thrilling and horrifying about that. There's something so bizarrely pleasurable about, or even desirous perhaps, about the knowledge that I had the power to throw myself off the bridge if I wanted to. And that used to freak me out, not because I wanted to throw myself off the bridge, but just because I was aware of this weird desire that comes out of knowledge of my power to throw myself off the bridge if I wanted to. And so this is another way to construe Freud's idea of the death drive that maybe is not so congratulatory. I mean, one of the things about Freud which perhaps is a little bit, and this particular way of construing Freud's death drive in terms of narrative, is that some of the most expressive pieces of music or works of art, particularly in the 20th century, late 20th century, precisely skeptical about whether or not a piece of art needs to mean anything, needs to be meaningful. In fact, the very idea that pain is only good if it can be made meaningful. Maybe there's something just sort of immediately pleasurable about pain, whether or not we're able to fit it into a narrative, right? That there's something kind of, so back to the question in Vertigo, this idea of death both as an object of desire and an object of dread, right? This idea that it seems to be both at the same time, are basically expressions of Freud's theory of the death drive. One thing to take from this, though, that you can think of the death drive and the pleasure principle cooperating. This idea of pain and pleasure coming together to make meaning in life. Okay, so this brings us now back to Vertigo. A lot of the stuff we've already talked about, but the way that there seems to be this obsessive desire to return to painful experiences throughout the film. And the way that the film seems to be cyclical. This is all on the website, so I don't think I'll spend very much time with this. If you want, you can go back and look over this. It's just basically a summary of some of the symmetries in the narrative, which might be interesting. But since we're running out of time, I'd like to talk a little bit about music and the way that music seems to be this interesting nexus between love, desire, eros, and death, Thanatos, fear, vertigo. So there are many different ways that we could talk about this. As you know, there are basically, it's like an hour and 45 minutes of music. So there's a ton of music that's going on. I mean, it's as long as many operas. And so I'm only sort of scratching the surface of the musical structure and complexity in this film, but I hope to maybe shed light on a few things that really are descriptive of this interesting nexus between desire and death. Okay, so let's start with the two main themes that we have throughout. So if you remember the title music, when you have the woman's face, you get this. You get the weird zoom shot, the vertigo shot, and you get this sort of singer and brass, right? So that's one of the things. And then one of the other things that I mentioned the other day, which is sort of interesting, is this love thing that happens time and time again. If you take the two key areas, the
two keys that these themes are in, you'll find that they're basically as far apart as possible. Now, what I mean by that is if you imagine a piano or a keyboard. Actually, Mike, since there aren't that many of you, I can never remember how many people have lots of music theory and how many people don't. But if I take an octave, you probably know that if you go up a scale, that the note repeats once you get up to the octave. It's the same note. I mean, it's higher, but they sound like the same note instead of sounding like two different notes. If you take the exact midpoint between the octave, you count up, you know, there are 12 semitones, so you count up and you get to this note. Okay? That's exactly halfway between the octave. And what's interesting about this is that these two things are in those two locations. The first thing, the vertigo, is here. Halfway in between is the key for the love thing. So the love thing is. So basically, what's very interesting is that the love thing and the death thing, the vertigo thing, the thing that's associated with, you know, Freudian castration, that is to say, debilitation, paralysis, death, even falling to death, fear, this sort of thing. They're as far apart as possible in pitch space. Now, what's very interesting is that there are a number of other things going on in the film, a number of other musical things that connect these two worlds, the death thing and the love thing. So, in the case, if you remember, there are two other musical cues which I think are interesting to talk about. There's the music that's associated with Carlotta Valdez, and it's also the music that's constantly there in the dream. It sounds kind of like a Spanish dance. In fact, even in the dream, there's like a castanet part, so they're playing castanets in the dream to really show that it's really Spanish. And it has this rhythmic idea going on. So you have that thing that's there at various points. Now, what's interesting is the music where Jimmy Stewart is following her around in the car. It's like a strange variation on that idea, but it's set up in a way that is very unstable rhythmically. So, you know, the Spanish music is very stable. You feel very strong. Instead of starting on a strong beat, it sort of shifts the beat over, so it sounds a little bit strange relative to where the really strong sort of down beat is. And that sounds like this. Unstable in the meter, unstable relative to where like the big strong beat is. So that's sort of interesting, maybe something that we would want to interpret. But the other thing that's interesting about this this moment is that the ostinato that goes together with the driving scene acts as an intermediary between these two different pitch worlds, the world of the vertigo thing and the world of the love thing. So if I, for instance, take the first chord here, just the driving scene, but it's very interesting the way that that works. And one of the reasons why that's so interesting is that, you know, there's constantly this cat and mouse sort of struggle between who's in control. Jimmy Stewart seems to be in control, but really think about what he's doing. He's constantly following her around. She's the one who decides where to go. And by the end of the film, it doesn't really seem, even though he seems to have gotten on some very local level what he wanted, he doesn't really seem to be completely in control of himself. And it's a really interesting moment where you get this music of Carlotta Valdez, and perhaps Madeline by extension, that is very harmonically stable and very metrically stable. It has very strong sort of dance rhythm. And then at other times when he's following her around, it's shifted to this much more unstable music, rhythmically unstable music. But that unstable music is sort of in between the keys of the death thing and the keys of the love thing, which is sort of interesting. There's one other element about this, which is worth noting, because beyond these various elements, the vertigo thing, or death thing, the love thing, and the music, like the driving music, or the Carlotta Valdez music, Bernard Herrmann, the composer of the score, sort of obsessively throughout the movie is quoting the Tristan chord. I don't know if you've heard it. It's a little bit hard to hear, even for me, especially when people are talking over it, if it's exactly the Tristan chord or not. But there are some really important moments. In fact, the Tristan chord really only seems to ever appear at important moments. So, like, for instance, at the moment where Judy's transformation is complete when she walks out of the elevator, at the moment you see her, there's this big stinger in the score, and the stinger is the Tristan chord. The Tristan chord is there when she runs up the first time to throw herself off the bell tower. It's constantly a subtext throughout the piece. And, you know, just by way of reference, one of the things I said about Wagner and Tristan is that and in particular the Tristan chord, one of the reasons it's so influential is just how many people imitate it and how many people actually make reference to it in music. Bernard Herrmann is making reference to it all over the place in this movie. One of the things that's interesting about Tristan and Isolde is that it's a story of star-crossed lovers that can only achieve the fulfillment of their desire in death. They're not able to actually consummate their sexual desire. It's sort of like Romeo and Juliet. In fact, Romeo and Juliet is probably derived from Tristan and Isolde, which was a medieval tale of courtly love. But
is this one where there's like a gap in the wall and they look at each other through the gap in the wall?
There's a gap in the wall, I don't remember.
Play,
you mean at the very end while we're. There's a scene at Tristan and Isolde where she sees Tristan, and it's a little unclear if he's already died or not. There may be a gap. Well, I don't remember exactly. But for our purposes, what's interesting is just the way that narrative is particularly interested in this idea of the sort of dual aspect of desire and death.
in many of the ways that we've described in terms of resolution to cadence as a form of death and this sort of thing. But Bernard Herrmann is specifically using this harmony, the Tristan chord, as both a symbol of the story of Tristan and Isolde and its very famous conceit of the, I suppose, the unity of desire and death, or the notion that desire and death are perhaps just two aspects of the same driving force. But what's really interesting about this harmonica, and I hope that this makes sense, is that the Tristan chord, the Tristan chord is very, very interesting because it can act as a nexus point between three very important key areas in this piece. It acts as a nexus to get to the key of the vertigo theme, it acts as a point to get to the love theme, and it can also act as a point to get to C major, which is the chord of those big trumpet fanfares that happen three times in the film. The first time that the C major trumpet fanfare happens is when they kiss, their desires finally, I suppose, consummated after the tree scene when they're on the beach. The next time is after Scotty has completely transformed Judy into Madeline, and finally he's happy and kisses her. And then the third time is when she throws herself off the window, out of the window. And so C major is this other building block, and it's very interesting that the Tristan chord is used so pervasively, and what it's doing harmonically is connecting love, death, and then some sort of very questionable triumph. And I can play that for you so you can get a sense of what that means. This is the Tristan chord. So if I do this, I can resolve it here. Sorry. So that was resolving to the vertigo thing or the death thing. I could do this. Just a few closing words about the way that this works out, sort of to sum up some of the ideas where I'm trying to bring Wagner, Freud, Hitchcock, Noel Carroll all together. hope I can do it in 11 minutes. I think I can. So, we have the vertigo theme, which is an E-flat minor. We have the love theme, which is an A minor, and they're as far apart as possible. C major chord, that triumphant brass fanfare at various points that are all combined by the Tristan chord, which can resolve equally well to any of those keys. So the Tristan chord is sort of this weird element that unites love, death, and all these other sorts of moments. There's the moment where the C major chord, as this very questionable triumph at the end, is this moment where fantasy is realized in Judy's death, but it seems, as I've already said in the lecture today, somewhat questionable and might lead us to realize that fantasy realized is nightmare, because perhaps if we don't desire anything, is there anything worth living for, or does our life have any meaning if we don't have pain in our lives? So to completely remove pain seems to create a situation in which it removes the possibility for meaning. Just a few other things to say about this. I think most of this I've said already, but to sum up basically some of the things that Noel Carroll's talking about as regards love and the way that narrative plays a role in his account of love, I think it's very interesting, and I think that there's a certain amount to be said about Peter Brook's idea of the death principle, the principle that pain, if it can be fit into a narrative, can be made meaningful. Basically, what Will Carroll is describing is a situation in which Scotty's project to transform Judy into Madeline is doomed to failure, because what he's missing some very important part of the equation for love. What he's trying to do is, instead of have a relationship with a person where love is born out of a mutual narrative, a shared history, what he's trying to do is objectify Judy. He's trying to turn her into an object with a certain set of properties that he thinks he wants. And that's something we typically think about desire. I mean, in terms of, that's the thing I want, and I want it because it will do this, that, this, and this for me. But one thing I will say, you know, in a lot of psychoanalytic theory, there's this idea that we constantly desire, and if we don't desire, then we might as well be dead. But, you know, it's very true that at some point, I suppose, I was about to say, it's very true that at some point in my past, I desired the woman that I married. It's not exactly what I meant to say. But, you know, where, like, desire was a big thing. But desire and happiness, I think, are really different things. I think that you don't necessarily need to desire to be happy. And I think that the sort of happiness that I'm describing here is very similar to what Noel Carroll described. It's only possible through shared narrative. It's not possible because I somehow have created this object that has the properties that I think that I want, that I can then more or less exploit or extract value from, or this sort of thing. But rather, it's only through a shared narrative of mutual pains and sometimes triumph over pain in which love becomes possible, in which happiness in love as well becomes possible. And there's a really great way to sum this up by this, I probably don't even know who this is, this Slovenian philosopher, Slavoj Žižek. You've probably seen this, I don't know. He has this famous thing where he talks about how, you know, you think about online dating and how, in some ways, it seems like this tech revolution, but in reality, what it is a return to arranged marriages, basically. Because what you do is say, well, I want my partner to have these properties. I have these properties to offer. And then let's, you know, I guess get married. Instead of, what he says, experiencing the rupture, experiencing the trauma of love. And he talks about how the French and the English have this beautiful phrase where they say, to fall in love. And the idea is that the fall is horribly traumatic, actually. It's a rupture in your everyday, you know, mastery of the world. It's a rupture in perhaps even the values that you think you have. And yet, it's this sort of rupture, this openness to meaningful failure, perhaps, that enables the sort of love that can come out of a shared narrative. And so, Scotty's problem, to synthesize Žižek and Noel Carroll, two people that consider themselves synthesizable, I guess. What Scotty's basic problem is, he wants love without the fall. He wants love in Judy Madeline to be the thing that he has control over, the object that he has made, instead of to be open to the rupture, to the perhaps meaningful trauma even of the fall of love. That's the end of my lecture. We still have a couple minutes for comments or questions. Yeah.
I just think it's to synthesize Carroll and Žižek, because Carroll's main contribution was to argue against psychoanalysis in cinema studies. But then what Carroll's arguing against isn't understanding the narrative psychoanalytically, but understanding the situation of the spectator and the psychology of watching. That's what Carroll.
Yeah, I
think it's funny, but once you throw that out the window, you actually talk about the film, they do get along very well. I think that's interesting.
Well, wait, they, who gets along very well?
Carol and Žižek.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, the reason I said that they might not consider themselves synthesizable mutually, might not consider that, is just because they come from perhaps somewhat antagonistic fields or backgrounds.
Directly antagonist. Yeah. Okay, Carroll hates
psychoanalysis. Yeah, I know.
And Žižek is.
But I think that there's actually a lot to be said. In fact, There's a lot of similarity in, well, this is getting kind of in the weeds, but Zizek's idea comes from some of the French theory of Jean Lacan, and this idea of, so one of the ideas, so if you read much literature on vertigo, a lot of it is very highly influenced by French psychoanalytic theory that specifically raises the question, is romantic love even something that is possible? Mm-hmm. And the reason that, this is really paraphrasing, but the reason that Lacan doesn't think that it's possible is that in romantic love, as opposed perhaps to some other form of love, I'm not sure what Lacan would say about, say, brotherly love or this sort of thing, but in romantic love, there's a necessary component of objectification. That, like, the very idea that there's sexual desire, that there's something about that that is objectifying, that you're never going to completely be able to treat the other as an end in themselves if you're also basically sexually using them or sexually, you know, somehow using them as the fulfillment of your desire. That's basically the idea. And so then, in this case, the whole argument that Milkow seems to be making about the object account of love seems actually kind of similar, right? That, like, yeah, it's a failure because there's always this element of, you know, objectification in what we call romantic love or in sexual love, this sort of thing, sexual desire. I don't know if that's actually true. I think that you could probably make a pretty persuasive alternate account, but there are similarities. At least in this article, but not some French analytic theory, psychoanalytic theory. But in particular, this idea of the narrative, you know, sort of being the way to construe our relationships with others instead of others as objects that you know, we can maybe exploit or not, seems to be kind of just something that I like.
I get all the talk about him making her an object,
yeah.
But it seems to me like it's what's more sinister. If he's trying to recreate a previous situation, it's more situational, less that he wants her.
I don't know about that. I mean, because he doesn't want her to like be walking around in the days, going to the museum. I mean, he doesn't want her to be doing the actions. He wants her to have a set of properties, really. I mean. All the things that we associate with Madeline Carlotta as beyond just the way she looks or the car she drives or whatever, it's about her activities, right? It's about the narrative that she's creating through her actions, right? But that's not what he wants. He doesn't want that component of it. He wants just a woman who looks exactly like, mm-hmm. like her. And he apparently doesn't even, you know, well, I'm not sure. This is maybe reading too much into the psychology of it. Behind the scenes, but he doesn't seem to be too terribly bothered that Judy, even as Madeline, is quite obviously from a different social class. You know? Seems pretty okay with that. It's really just that he, you know, wants a particular set of physical properties, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, in a way, like, it's sort of similar to, like trying to, like, everybody in their own, like, has their own like certain like quirks or desires of a certain person, right?
Mm.
This is just more like intense version of like,
yeah.
I want this or I want that in a person. Like I want someone that is good looking in this way, or I want somebody to have this particular quality,
mm-hmm.
right? Like
even though we tell ourselves that we are above that.
Right, but like in reality.
But
like
that's part of why you have this idea that in sexual love actually there is always an element of a certain irreducible element of objectification.
Yeah.
I don't know, and it sort of almost seems like we don't talk about this politely, but I think deep down probably a lot of us feel that if there are people that really don't have that there's something wrong with them. That is to say, like, someone who wouldn't have any problem making love to somebody who's, like, in their 80s, you know, they may be a beautiful person, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
At the same time, there's something wrong with that, right? Or there's something wrong with, you know, someone who, we wouldn't say that it's wrong, but I think somehow deep down, if we're honest with ourselves, we feel like, man, there's something wrong about, like, being sexually attracted to someone who's a paraplegic or something, or even, you know, I don't know what it is exactly, but there does seem to be something kind of, it's certainly not polite to say, but I remember, I think I was watching Geraldo Rivera or something, and there was, this was like in the 90s, and there was an episode where it was like the first Playboy model who was in a wheelchair or something. Which, you know, when we, see, I don't want to turn this into a situation where me and my limited sphere of power is making pronouncements that I myself don't necessarily agree with, but there does seem to be a sort of divide between our lofty expressions of equality and rights and these sorts of things and sexual desire, right? There does seem to be something sort of deep-seatedly objectifying and self-interested about sexual desire. And so, you know, one way of describing this is that all romantic love is essentially narcissistic, right? And it's actually really interesting. I mean, if you have a crush on somebody and you see that they do something that you don't like, you feel betrayed. But, like, if you see they're a smoker or something, it could be something as trivial as that. Why else should you have that sort of, or me at least, I'll just talk about my own experience, why would, if it's really not narcissistic, if it's really that you love that person for who they are instead of how you can use them, why would those sorts of things be a rupture in that, and the sort of rupture where you might actually feel disappointed in them or something, if not for the fact that you're self-projecting your own beliefs, desires, values onto another person, right? And so from that point of view, you're not treating them as an enemy themselves. What you're doing is treating them as a way of perhaps objectifying your own beliefs about yourself, right? They're a tool for you to, in some sense, feel good about yourself, to just sort of, you know, have a romantic or a sexual, you know, the pleasure of even just having the feelings, having the desires. So, yeah.
I'm glad you bring that up. I've been thinking a lot recently about the character of George Costanza. How, like, in pretty much every episode of Seinfeld, his arc, his mission is to break up with a woman and end the relationship for some reason. But that it's a quest to end your romantic and sexual relationship with someone once they, because there's a point where she's no longer an object, she's a person that is dependent on him, or he's dependent on her in some way. Just, I find it very interesting, the challenge of ending a romance.
Yeah.
I said that about Jerry and Elaine too. They also seem like they're always trying to break up with somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting about that, I guess, is there's the level of someone else needing something, and you could think it's just egotistical, but at the same time, there's a certain element of self-hate, right, wherein they want to love and be loved, but as soon as somebody loves them, they push them away. Right? Yeah, and so, you know, this might be a form of sort of internalized aggression, self-aggression, this sort of thing, but yeah. That it's not just about egotism and self-interest, it's also about, in some sense, self-destruction. Right? It's very interesting. Anyway, I feel kind of weird, because next time we won't have very much time for discussion, because the movie just takes the whole period. Actually, one thing about the movie, it's slightly longer, it's like 5 or 10 minutes longer than our class period, so we could either start earlier or end late. Which would you prefer? It'll go like 10 minutes over the class time.
Which
one?
Yeah.
Oh, it's 2001.
Oh,
hell yeah. It's also nice that we have pretty good subwoofers up there. I like that.
Can I bring some friends?
Yeah, sure. It's actually, I've seen it too many times to sustain what I'm about to say, but for most of my life, it has been my favorite movie. It's really good.
It is.
And it, in a way, it really intensifies some of the things that we see with Hitchcock, where the plot doesn't matter, right? The story. What matters is the articulation, is the way it's told. And it's told with such beautiful surgical precision, while at the same time exploring really out there ideas, but in a really precise way. It's the Spinoza of filmmaking, I think. You know, it's just like so precise and so, in a way, methodical, but the end product is this worldview that's so.
Yes, all the explaining.
Yeah.
It's your deal.
Well, the Euclidean stuff is, you know, like the way he uses montage and hard cuts and timing and control of proportion is really good. But then, you know, the worldview is on the order of like, you know, thought extension of just two aspects of the same. Yeah. And everything is basically one.
Have you ever did the masking exercise?
Yeah. I did.
That Matt Johnson movie?
I did.
What did you think of that? I'm very curious.
Well, you know, actually, the first thing I'll say, I liked it very much. Among all the very many references, it also references Elephant, the movie we were talking about, all over the place.
It does?
Yeah. Like the t-shirt he's wearing, the yellow shirt with the bowl, that's straight out of Elephant.
Okay.
One of the main characters, and some of the other elements in it, too. I thought it was very good, actually. It's funny, I didn't see very good reviews of it anywhere. Which doesn't mean anything. That's usually the case. And, the things that I like usually have pretty bad reviews. Either they're actually really terrible and I like them, or they're really great and everybody else thinks they're terrible. I don't know. What's there to say about it? I mean, I kind of looked very briefly into his other stuff. You know, I guess maybe the most interesting thing is just how the sort of confluence of different genres, like the reality comedy thing in the school shooting situation, is there's something kind of nice, and how hard it is to read the characters in terms of whether or not it's actually parody and satire. You know, one of the things that I did mention, which I also think is kind of interesting, I mentioned in this class the day after I watched it, because we're talking a little bit about suture theory, which is basically just a theory of the apparatus of filmmaking and the structure of rhetoric and persuasion. And one of the main conceits in suture theory is that film, well, any artwork actually, not just film, can work in a sort of propagandistic way, provided that the apparatus is hidden,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, whenever you become aware of the camera placement or become aware that you're sitting in the theater watching a movie, being told a specific story, it doesn't work very well for propaganda. And I was talking about this in relation to the editing techniques in Alexander Nevsky relative to the more avant-garde editing techniques that Eisenstein became famous for.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's interesting about, what's the movie called again? Oh, The Dirties, yeah. Is how, because it's filmed in this cinema verite style, well, you know, I don't even know if it's apt to call it cinema verite, because it's more like The Office, where it's like really planned cinema verite, and it's very like self-aware of trying to seem natural in a way that in the 50s, cinema verite was actually kind of like a revolutionary against studio production, and it was actually trying to actually seem natural, be natural, instead of just being calculated naturalism, you know, or naturalisticness. But one of the things that comes out of this is the scenes where they're not actually making the film and how much you forget about the camera being there, precisely because they're not being filming, right? And so there's actually a scene where they draw attention to this, where
Matt, or does he have, is that his name in the movie?
I don't remember.
Matt is like doing some weird kung fu thing on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah.
And his friend is like, who are you doing this for? We're not filming. And it's like, I'm doing it because it's funny. And then his friend says, it's not funny to me, so who are you doing it for? But of course, they are filming. But mm-hmm. it's very interesting the way that, like, until he specifically made the point that they're not filming, that was a moment where I realized that I'm watching a movie. You know, whereas it's interesting how sort of seamlessly and easily the apparatus of storytelling or of an artwork, if you have a really immersive experience, can just sort of disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a kind of interesting moment where that precise element of rhetoric and persuasion was tentative.
The moment I think is really very neat is maybe earlier on when they make their first film and then they're showing it to their teacher.
Yeah.
And all of the attention is on the film within the film.
Yeah.
And you forget that you're watching
a film within a film.
You forget that you're watching the first, you know, the actual film because you're watching them watch the internal one.
Yeah, I guess
the focus
from that point of view, are you watching any other film at that point? Right. But actually, as I remember, it's not like their film from beginning to end just fills the entirety of the screen. Don't they, like, cut back to the class and their reactions?
I don't mean in the class. I mean when they show the teacher and he tells them they have
to trying to remember. It's quite common to have films within films where the film within the film actually just takes up the entire screen
mm-hmm.
and you're really just watching the film within the film. And then you could ask, well, am I even watching a film in a film? You know, I mean, in terms of the narrative, yes, but in terms of your own experience, there's no reason that you should remember that other people in the movie are watching this, because that seems kind of counterfactual. They're not actually in the movie at that point. All that's there is the image of...
Like the News on the March and Citizen Kane, where
yeah,
there's no even pretense of being in the movie. It's just exposition.
Right, yeah.
Propaganda exposition directly.
Yeah.
But with the scene I'm talking